to the Creative Pen Podcasts. I'm Joanna Penn, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options, internet sales and promotion for your book. The companion website is www.thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from the Creative Pen Podcast. This is episode number 132, and I'm recording this at the beginning of July 2012. So today, I'm getting deeper meaningful, and I guess I'm increasingly sharing stuff with you guys that in the past I might have kept more to myself, but you know, I figure we're meant to be honest and, you know, share a lot of our personal stuff in our writing, so why not do it on the podcast? So today we are talking religion and politics with Dr. Jill Carroll, who is an expert in this area. So we're going to dive deep into ourselves, and I guess in order to motivate writing for characters, because religion, spirituality, faith and where that also gets into paranormal, that type of thing, supernatural, are all part of, well, a part of most people's lives in some way. And the people's lives it isn't in tend to be people who are on the opposite end of the spectrum, in the kind of atheist group who are almost religious in their anti-religion. But today we're going to discuss a lot of this in more detail. And I think I explore the knife edge of this in my fiction, as I, you know, I am both respectful of religions, but also don't adhere to a particular one myself. But I am deeply fascinated with it, with my degrees in theology and also psychology, specialising in the psychology of religion. So, I'm a bit obsessive. It's quite surprising. This is the first time I've had this type of podcast, given that we're at 132. Anyway, I know this is an emotional topic and one that could provoke extreme reactions in people. So please feel free to leave a comment on the show notes that this is part of. Or you can email me, joanna@thecreativepen.com. But please be respectful of other people. And as ever, this is an equal opportunities blog. So, before we get into that, a little update. I am off to Thriller Fest in New York next week, and I'm so excited, you wouldn't believe it, because I haven't been to New York before, so I'm excited to see the city, and I've got a few days of sightseeing and things. But I'm also excited to be part of the convention and meet some of my author heroes, Lee Child, Lisa Gardner, Steve Berry, amongst others. But also some of my platform and online friends. So meeting Dan Blank and Mark Coker and, you know, several other people, which is quite exciting. I'll also be meeting up with my friend, New York Times bestselling author, CJ Lyons, who I've been working for now, working with for about 6 months on the Pro Writer series of multimedia courses, which are all now available. And they've it's been amazing. Actually, CJ has acted almost like a mentor for me, you know, given that I'm really at the beginning of the game, and she is got about 16 novels, as I said, New York Times bestseller, all those things. So she shares all of her secrets. We have four modules in there: secrets of traditional publishing success, secrets of independent publishing success, and now we've just released How to Market Your Book, and also Secrets of a Pro Writer, where CJ and I discuss the nuts and bolts of being a full-time author entrepreneur. So, and the marketing one especially is the culmination of everything I know about book marketing, as well as CJ's insights, and she sells 100,000 copies a month plus. Definitely worth listening to her. You can check all those courses out at thecreativepen.com/store, STORE, or you can find the store on the site. So that's pretty exciting, because that's been a lot of work putting together the videos and the audios and all the material for those courses. But they are pretty much now the cornerstone of the multimedia education that I'm providing on the Creative Pen. So that's really good. On the fiction side, I am just about 70,000 words on Exodus, the third in my Arcane series, which is Morgan Sierra kicking some butt and hunting down the Ark of the Covenant as the Middle East counts down to a religious war, which is quite exciting. And I must admit, I've been watching a lot of Krav Maga videos online. So today I've actually been writing fight scenes. I really enjoy that. I desperately want to go back to Krav Maga, which, if you don't know, it's an Israeli martial art. I went along to one class a few months back now, and it was seriously painful and emotionally draining, and so I never went back. But I would like to go back again, but part of me likes the ideas a lot more than the practicality, so maybe it's a case of my protagonist doing it all on my behalf. But anyway, so fiction, it is happening. I'm going to put the book aside while I'm in New York and then come back and finish it and kick its butt. So hopefully have that book out with editing in August, September probably. Other things, I have been challenged recently. I like being challenged. I think it's really important for us to challenge ourselves and use a lot of the resources we have to be challenged in our writing. I've been particularly sort of, again, kicked in the butt by Stephen Pressfield's new book, Turning Pro, which I absolutely recommend. And I've written a blog post about some of the things I learned. But it really cuts straight to the heart of being a pro versus an amateur in terms of your writing and your writing career. And I felt that in some ways I am a pro, but you know, right at the beginning of being a pro, but I am quite clearly an amateur in a lot of my mindset. Perhaps this is natural for where I am in the journey, which is pretty new and still raw and learning the game and the craft, as I hope always to be learning. But yeah, so I'm working on what he talks about. He also talks about the habits of professionals versus amateurs, and that we all struggle with resistance and fear, but the pro gets on with it anyway. And he talks a lot about just, you know, doing that writing. And that also resonated with a post I've read from the awesome thriller writer Jeremy Robinson's blog about how to write 4,000 words in a day, per day, every day, which I'm quite, again, challenged by. On good days, I'm writing around 1800 to 2000 words. Sometimes I go over that, but mostly I'm behind 4000. And interesting, in that post he talks about daydreaming, which we did mention a few podcasts ago in terms of creativity, but that daydreaming, he specifically applies it to fiction. So Jeremy talks about daydreaming about his books and his scenes, and he basically writes the plot, dreams the plot in his head, so that when he sits down to write, he can just describe what has already played out and he doesn't need to think it up while he's writing. Which I think is my issue, is that I know approximately what I'm going to write, but I don't know exactly, so I have to stop and think. So anyway, by doing this, he can write about 1,000 words an hour, and he does that 4 to 5 hours a day. So that's a challenge to us all, and something I will be working on personally as a professional habit. So, you know, even if you're, like many people, working full time, I certainly used to write 1,000 words before going to work when I was working full time, and that was, you know, getting up early. So it definitely can be done. Oh, non-fiction. Actually, it's good for me to do this introduction every 2 weeks. I think I'm doing it because it reminds me of how, you know, I have to reflect on what I've actually done and what I've achieved, which is good because I think we forget to celebrate sometimes. So I have actually released a book in the last week. I've rewritten and re-released the book of my heart, which is How to Love Your Job or Find a New One. I wrote the first edition back in 2008. It was my first sort of foray into self-publishing, and I then followed my own advice to change my career from IT consultant, miserable IT consultant, to full-time author entrepreneur. So I wanted to rewrite it, it's probably 70% rewritten, in that things have changed a lot, but I've put a whole new chapters in about being an entrepreneur. I've, you know, updated a lot of things in terms of what people can learn. So it's self-help, non-fiction, and, you know, if you love your job, fantastic. If you want to change your career, you might enjoy it or recommend it to other people who might find it useful. It is on Amazon at the moment, and it will be on the other ebook stores later, and I may even do a print version, but right now it's on Amazon, or you can check it out at thecreativepen.com/lovejob, and there's also a workbook, free workbook, you can download from that page. Okay, so busy, I guess, but lots of fun. I really am having a good time. I hope you guys get that. And yeah, on with the podcast. As ever, remember you can email me questions or feedback or anything, joanna@thecreativepen.com. I look forward to hearing from you, and here's the interview. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today I'm interviewing Dr. Jill Carroll. Jill is a Houston-based scholar, writer, and speaker who specializes in world religions and applied life philosophy. She is the author of 3 non-fiction books and an upcoming novel, and she also runs the Amazing Faiths Project, which encourages interfaith dialogue and friendship. So welcome, Jill.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's great to meet you finally after being online.
Yeah, after being on Twitter, we feel like we know the whole world on Twitter.
We do. So today we're going to be discussing how religion and spirituality affects our writing, and for the listeners, really how you can use it in your books to bring depth and meaning. But I should explain up front, you know, for everybody listening today, Jill has a PhD in religious studies, and I have a master's in theology from Oxford. So the pair of us are, you know, probably well educated.
Yeah, between the both of us, we've got a lot of knowledge, I suppose.
We do. So we're going to try and not get too deep and meaningful about that. But Jill, why don't you start by telling us, how did you become so interested in this topic? And does it relate to your own personal beliefs?
Yeah. You know, I was raised in a very religious family, a very conservative Christian family. And so I guess what I can say is that religious ideas are the first sort of ideas that I ever had as a person. And so they just were very compelling to me all growing up. And I just love the world of it. I loved the questions and the ideas and the stories of religion even as a child. And so as I, you know, grew up and went to college, this was my area of study. And even though my own personal faith journey ended up changing so that I left Christianity in my mid-20s and haven't practiced any faith for the last 20-something years, 25 years or so, it's still very much a part of the background of my life and my thinking. And I just have reels and snarls of religious ideas and teaching in my brain and in my consciousness. So, I'm a scholar. I study the world's religions, and I'm very much steeped in them in that way. But it's there in the background of my psyche, so I don't think I'll ever get away from it, nor would I want to.
Yeah, and I really like that, because that very much reflects my experience. You know, I was a Christian in my teens, and then as I studied, I kind of grew out of that faith. But I would say I'm a spiritual person, and it sounds like you are as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's a category of people now that religious study scholars are studying, the people who say they're spiritual but not religious.
Yeah,
that's
I'm
almost
there.
Like a new religion, you know. So,
but I think that's the first thing I wanted to bring up. You know, sort of a point for people is that you can. I mean, people want to put
believers in a box. And I, you know, when I say believers, you know, I'm like those of us who are spiritual as well. But, you know, it doesn't have to go in a box, does it? In fact, this, it's more like a spectrum, I guess.
I think that's a good word, the word spectrum. There's room for everyone. I mean, you know, religion is, I think, arguably the oldest cultural product of human beings. We've been doing religion since we've been human.
Yeah.
And we've been creating it and telling the stories of it and living inside of it and having religion, creating religion to tell us what's most important. And as many kinds of humans as there have been and are today, there are that many different religious expressions.
Mm. I like that phrase, cultural product, because I also... you know, believe that it really does depend on where you're born, you know, in terms of what you start with, you know.
And absolutely.
If we'd have been born in the Middle East, we would have been raised Muslim perhaps, and then may have lost that faith. But there's that definitely is a cultural side of things.
Absolutely. We could have been born in India. We would be Hindu, Muslim, Jain, Sikh. I mean, it's, you know, religion is a geography as much as it's anything.
Yeah, and that's the next point I want to raise. And it's really, I guess my aim with this podcast is to really make people think about how they integrate religion and faith into their novels. And that geography aspect, for me, is also critical because I love settings. And my novel, my first novel, Pentecost, the opening scene is Varanasi.
I know. And it's an incredible opening scene. I was just reading it last night. And it's amazing.
You.
I mean, I was scared to death what you did with that nun.
I'm glad. But I put, you know, when I wanted to have a nun there, but of course the burning at the Ghats there, you know, is just this sort of ancient, again, cultural but also religious product.
Oh, it's incredible. I mean, you know, and I'm sure we were, you know, in your list of questions, we'll get to this, but this is a good point to jump in. You know, the opening of your novel is a perfect example of how the religions of the world, I think, are just hardwired for anyone, any creative, whether you're a novelist or a visual artist or a musician or anything, because the world's religions contain all the great art.
Mm.
And they're located in all of the whole world. And so you've got these gorgeous settings, these beautiful, rich, mystical, powerful geographic settings. And right there, you've got all the powerful dramatic elements. In Varanasi, for example, you've got fire, chanting, water, river, music, the sadhus, the holy people. You've got all these really powerful dramatic elements, and they're just right for anyone who's a creative to come in and make use of them and inhabit them.
Mm. Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons I try and bring it in. It's like you can say one word to people who have a certain background, and there will be a whole history of resonance behind that word. You know, so the third one is going to be called Exodus, and just the word Exodus means something to
absolutely
people.
It's a symbol. I mean, these things are not just words, they're symbols, they're powerful cultural symbols and religious symbols, and I think as such they touch people very deeply, because that's where we hold religion. We don't hold it only in our minds or in our brains at the level of logic or analysis or rationality. We hold it deep inside us, in our gut, you know, in our deepest selves, at a sort of subconscious level. And so when you say a word like Exodus or prophecy or Pentecost, these are your novels, that all sorts of things are evoked at a very visceral level.
I'm glad you get that.
Yeah, it's true.
That's funny. So on that, I mean, we're talking there about some people have very strong reactions, and that's strong in the negative as well as in the positive, obviously. Mm-hmm. So when, you know, what is it about religion that makes the whole thing so emotional and difficult?
Yeah, it seems inherently combustible. I think it's because religion is the cultural product in which we ask and answer the deepest questions of human existence. Who are we? Why are we here? How did we get here? What are we supposed to do now that we're here? How should we live? What's good? What's bad? What happens when we die? Why do we die? Why does everything and everyone we love die? These are the deepest questions of human existence, and we've been asking these questions ever since we've been human. And religion puts these questions front and center, and it answers them. And we get very attached to our answers because they're the deepest questions we have. I mean, we pin our lives on the answers to these questions. And so when we have our answers settled through our religious framework, and then some alternative vision or an alternative set of answers comes along, often we feel that as a threat. Because the Buddhists have a phrase called clinging and grasping, that we cling and grasp to things. And I think we're very attached. We cling and grasp to our answers of meaning. And if we locate that meaning within a religious framework, it's almost like it gives it capital letters.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it gives it a kind of cosmic authority that we don't want to let go of, and we can be sometimes tempted into coercing others with.
Mm.
So I think you see the history of the religions as sometimes a history of that.
Yeah, and I think one of the issues with writing novels with people, you know, who have various beliefs in, is that it can become, we can use very big words, and some of the things you've said there are very big concepts, and when we write, we actually have to bring these big concepts down to specific individuals and their specific experiences with that.
Yeah.
Which can be very hard, can't it?
It can be very hard, and I think it sometimes lends itself to one-sided characterization of people. For example, if you're going to have, for example, maybe an evangelical or conservative Christian in your novel, and then they're going to encounter someone from a different faith, maybe an atheist or a Muslim or someone, it would be very easy to just lower everyone down to the lowest common denominator, and they would all be just fundamentalists of various sorts, fighting with each other, and there would be no nuance. But actually, if you scratch the surface of even, you know, people who would call themselves fundamentalists, there's a lot going on with people with regard to religion. There's fear, there's anxiety about the modern period, about modern life, about how things seem to be falling apart, and traditional values don't seem to hold anymore, and the world doesn't seem safe, and there's all sorts of things that, you know, if you're creative, you can probe that and tease that out. But we have to first begin to see people like this as human beings that are complex and not just caricatures like what we see in the news.
Yeah, and I think that that's a really good point. And I think for those of us, you know, well, there are lots of Muslims in the West, but, you know, the Muslim fundamentalist stereotype is just overdone.
Completely overdone. And it's such an injustice to that religion and to the beautiful people and cultures of that tradition.
Mm.
Yes, there's so much diversity there.
There is. And I guess I know you've written on this, you know, the interfaith stuff, and I've seen all the pictures on your website of you with various, you know, Muslims and different people of different faiths.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any practical way in which people can learn more about this or meet people of other faiths without actually coming across as, you know, patronizing, I guess? Like, I'm learning about you and your faith, you know?
Well, yeah, it is tricky. Interfaith, a lot of the most robust interfaith work in the last 10 years, at least over here in America, and I think throughout the West since 9/11, since the event of 9/11, and I'm not sure what's happened since the London episode, 7/7.
Mm.
Over here, when 9/11 happened, you know, there was just this burst of interfaith activity because there was this idea that, oh my gosh, we have to learn to understand each other. You know, Muslims did this to our country, and why are they doing this? And oh my goodness. And so there was this real explosion of interfaith activity. And so we had lots of opportunities where people from different faiths could come together at a dinner or at an event or at some sort of a dialogue and begin to get to know each other as people and to ask questions and to just to understand each other. And so I think a lot of those things still exist, and they're a perfect way to do something that may feel a little bit uncomfortable, you know, just to sort of go up to someone and ask them about their faith. So it kind of sets up that opportunity. But the fact is, I mean, in the UK, here in America, we have very diverse societies, and the chances are that most of us either live or work or go to school or something with people of different faiths. And it's just a matter of building those relationships to a level where we can talk about it and ask each other questions. And myself, I'm a firm believer that the more we extend ourselves outside of our comfort zone of relationships into friendships that go beyond our comfort zone, the better off our society is, because I mean, it's our destiny. We all have to live together.
Yeah, absolutely.
We don't have a choice about that.
Yeah, and we don't want to go back. I'm a massive fan of multiculturalism. I love being back in London after Australia, which is really quite monocultural. Mm-hmm. Especially Queensland and Brisbane there. It's, you know, very sort of white middle class. And
exactly.
Yeah, it's great being back in London. But I also wanted to ask you, what was nice there is you said after 9/11 there was a rise in interfaith dialogue. I mean, I haven't actually been to America since 9/11, and that's not what we heard in the rest of the world. You know, what we heard was, you know, Muslims being mugged and basically an escalation in violence between religions. So what you've said is that, you know, when something happens, people do react in a positive way as well as a negative way when something happens around religion.
Oh yeah, and we did what you heard was not incorrect. Especially in the immediate weeks, days and weeks after 9/11, we did have violence against Muslims and mosques. We had vandalism of their mosques. We had people who were mistaken as Muslims, Sikhs. We had some Sikhs who were attacked and others. And so you had that happen. And that right there also prompted people in interfaith work to really ramp up their efforts. So you had both. You had the rise in both.
Yeah, and I think, again, bringing people back to that, we mustn't just jump on, you know, stereotypes of a reaction. We've got to look at other things. So I also wanted to ask you about the truth. You know, what is your perception of Christianity in the US? Because, again, from my perspective in the UK, it seems, that there's a rise in Christian fundamentalism as much as there is a rise in Islamic fundamentalism in the Middle East.
Yeah. Well, you know, Christianity has been the dominant religion of the United States since its founding, and the particular form of Christianity that has been the most dominant for all of the country's history is evangelical Christianity, which is a more conservative, traditional form. And right now, evangelical Christianity is sometimes sliding into a kind of fundamentalism. I think I'm speaking purely from a scholarly perspective in terms of the analysis. I think many people who analyze this will say that in many ways this is sort of the dying breath, the last, you know, death throes, the death rattles of a worldview that's dying. That many of the really hardline Christian right fundamentalist folks, that perspective is just losing out. It's just obvious in the demographics, in the polls. Young people are not buying into this, and so there's a definite shelf life on that viewpoint, and that this is the sort of final death rattle.
Yeah. That is very interesting. And again, this is, you know, part of what I wanted to talk about is how different the news, you know, and the media portrays the situation. Because that's not at all what I would have expected you to say. You know, it seems certainly with, and again, bringing into politics, you know, a lot of political thrillers are quite big, aren't they, these days? And I don't think you can talk about politics right now without getting into religion. You know, with Mitt Romney, you know, in the US, it's all anyone seems to talk about. It's his Mormonism.
Yeah, well, and his Mormon, the fact that he's Mormon, you know, that becomes a big issue over here.
Yeah, exactly.
Because Mormonism is a homegrown United States religion. There's real animosity between mainline traditional Christians on the one hand and Mormons on the other. So it ends up being It ends up being a news item.
Yeah, which is fascinating. And I should say for, you know, for the US people listening to this, in England, the what is big in the news right now is Richard Dawkins and atheism. Mm-hmm. So there's almost a religion of atheism that has come up, which is very much anti-religion. So it's not where we are, which is, you know, people who respect religion and have studied it. It's kind of, he studied it and come out with, you know, I am against religion. Is that, do you see that at all in the US, that sort of militant atheism?
We're starting to see it. I mean, Dawkins comes over here and does lecture tours. We, you know, Hitch, the late Christopher Hitchens, he was over here on lecture tours. We have our own Sam Harris, who has done work, you know, in the line of that. So, and the numbers show that people in the United States who are willing to self-identify as atheists is dramatically rising. From the single digits up into maybe even the low 20s, high, you know, 18 to 20% are admitting to either being agnostic or atheist. And for a country like America, that's a huge number.
That is.
And so, I mean, we're getting some of that, but we're used to it over here. I mean, we're a very religious country. People stridently are religious about all sorts of things. You know, people start religions over here. You know, you just get a 1-800 number and a credit card account, and you start a religion over here. I mean, this is just what we do. So I think people kind of take it in stride. But yeah, it's kind of trendy right now. I get asked about the so-called new atheists a lot when I do lectures and things around the country.
Yeah, and that's interesting. And the whole cult kind of thing that, you know, some people talk about for Americans as well. I wonder if, you know, you have any opinion on the type of people. Again, we, you know, for this whole discussion, I want people to be thinking about characters and how these things can go in their books. But who are these people who kind of jump on these cults? You know, you say someone can just start a religion, and, you know, we've heard about many of these type of ideas, but, you know, how, what are the types of people who, I guess, start these things and the people that follow them?
Yeah, I don't know that if I could identify any one psychological profile of person who did this type of thing, I would make a lot of money. because that's the thing, is that there is no one type, not even within one religion or within one cult is there a type, or is there a one socioeconomic class or anything. I mean, the most successful of these things, they draw from all sorts of people. But the thing is that, you know, religions are one of the primary ways in which we make meaning in our lives. We create meaning for ourselves and for our lives. And for someone who's in a crisis of meaning, and it could be after a death in the family, it could be after a divorce, it could be after a tragic loss, it could be, you know, any time when someone is just psychologically, emotionally, and spiritually broken or vulnerable for any length of time, that's when something like a religion or a cult or something like that is potentially attractive. And especially if it's headed up by someone who's charismatic, who's magnetic, who's, you know, attractive in sort of the larger way. And so, and then it remains to be seen once the person becomes strengthened in themselves, if they're able to stay with it, or if it continues to meet their needs, or if they need to, you know, extricate themselves from it.
Here's a question for you, just crossed my mind. Are all of these cult and, you know, almost religious leaders, are they all male? Can you think of any female?
Well, you know, Christian Science, which is sort of a spinoff of Christianity, about 100, 120 years old, started by a woman, Mary Baker Eddy.
I'll give you one.
You have one of the big Hindu, the Amachi movement. She's a female guru from the Dalit. From the Dalit caste in India.
Untouchable, so-called untouchable.
Right, caste. And she has a huge worldwide following and a huge following in the West.
Fascinating. But, these types of cult leaders are really fascinating characters, aren't they? I mean,
that, oh yeah,
that is an interesting type of biography for people to look into if they want to write about a character like that.
Well, and they're so compelling. I mean, the truth is that the big religions of the world that we don't call cults, we just call them the big religions, like Islam and Christianity and Buddhism. They're all founded by individuals, and they all went through an early period of development when basically they were personality cults.
Mm.
And then the founder dies, and then the little cult movement is challenged to see if it can develop beyond that phase.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you know, the Jesus movement, when Jesus was alive, was a cult of personality.
Mm.
It just evolved past that. You know, so it's a wonderful question to ask. And as characters, these people are just amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, they're probably diagnosable, you know, in some way. I mean, and I say that with the utmost respect. I mean, I don't mean to demean any of these founders like Jesus or Muhammad or any of them. I say it with the utmost respect because these are not normal people.
Mm.
I mean, they hear voices.
Mm.
They do extraordinary things. They break away and twist off from normal life and lead these very alternative type lives. And there's a kind of greatness that you find in them. It's odd. It's scary. It's alluring, which is why they end up with followers. And so they're fantastic as characters. I mean, just fantastic.
Yeah, and let's face it, I mean, we don't write books to write about normality. That is boring.
That's boring.
Yeah, no one wants that. You know, so we got to bring something exciting and interesting, compelling into our books. And you know,
oh, yeah.
This is certainly...
And religion is the best way, one of the best ways to do that, because religion, by definition, is wild.
Mm.
There's a kind of wildness. There's an edge to religion. I mean, this is what all the religions do, especially in their mystical branches. They take you to that wild edge of existence. They put you in a trance state. You go into some sort of ecstatic, you know, something or other. I mean, they bring us as people into that edge of consciousness that's not the normal. The religions are a perfect place to begin creative work.
Yeah, no, I agree. And on that, I'm interested in one of your books, The Savage Side, Reclaiming Violent Models of God, which, you know, I was like, wow, that sounds fascinating. And you speak of using the natural world as a springboard for describing God. And I totally resonate with that because, you know, I have experienced God or spirit or whatever we want to call it most strongly in those sort of wild places. So, you know, can you tell us a bit more about that book and how people can use those ideas?
Sure, yeah. Well, I don't recommend reading it because it was my dissertation. It was my doctoral dissertation, which then got published. And so it's very academic. It's very dry. I don't recommend it unless you're just a glutton for punishment. So it's, you know, I had to write it for my degree. But the ideas themselves, I mean, I spend a lot of the book doing analysis of one of America's great nature writers. Her name is Annie Dillard.
Mm.
And she won a Pulitzer Prize in the 70s for her first book. And so a lot of that, of my book, is analyzing her work. But what happened, basically, it just says, look, we look at the natural world. It's a given. It's something that was here before us, and it'll be here when we're gone. And whatever it is, if it's God or source or spirit that's behind it, the natural world is a really powerful mirror for God or source or whatever. And when we look at that, we see that it's not moral. Mm. It's amoral. It's beyond morality. And this is a challenge to most of the religions of the world, which offer up these very powerful moral systems. And so that's, I spent a lot of time in the book dealing with that at a philosophical level, which is why I don't recommend that anybody read it unless you're totally interested in that, because it can get very dense.
Mm.
But I think maybe your experience might be similar, is that when we are out in the world, when we're out on the ocean or in the desert or in the world and we're connected to the natural rhythms, we immediately get plugged into something much, much bigger than we are.
Mm.
That operates according to its own logic. It doesn't operate according to our little conventional notions of what's right or wrong, or what's fair or unfair. And we have to face that. I think we have to live in that. We have to come to a place in our lives where we face the fact that the cosmos does not operate according to the same sensibilities as we do.
No, I agree. And I think, and it's kind of paradoxical, but, you know, the moments when I've felt that most clearly have been when I've been scuba diving, for example, where I look around me at the, you know, the sea life doing its thing, and I just realize how inconsequential I am, and how then this whole ocean will just be continuing, and if I just popped out of existence at that moment, nothing would change.
Exactly, which is alarming.
Yeah, alarming, but equally I think is it those moments that I feel most, you know, spiritual, because it's like, but I am here now, and, you know, but and also that the violence I think is important, you know, this violence in nature, this, you know, like you said, amoral, not evil, it's kind of just, it doesn't necessarily care.
Yeah, it's beyond good and evil in our notions. It's just there, and there's a kind of raw beauty to it. And, you know, maybe, I mean, I don't want to presume to interpret your experience in scuba diving, but in those moments when you have that realization that you could just pop out of existence and the larger ocean would just go on without you, it's alarming, but that can also be deeply, how should I say, I would imagine you could also feel a profound connection to all of it in that moment. Like, that it's okay if you just dissolve into that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's funny talking like then people are probably thinking we're getting a bit deep and meaningful now. But I think part of the difficulty that, you know, you can tell that both of us are struggling with putting into words some of this stuff. And that's also important for people to realise, is that this type of thinking can actually take you a lot deeper into your own beliefs and your own realizations, and that bringing that to your characters can be very powerful.
Oh yeah, totally. You know, I had this experience just writing my first novel, which I'm finishing right now. I mean, I finished it, it's just being in production right now, because I put my characters are out in the West Texas desert. And the desert it ended up becoming almost its own character in the novel, because of the sort of sparseness and the elegant beauty of it, and the fact that it is nurturing of such a variety of life in terms of animals and plants and the humans, but it's also very deadly. Everything out there has a blade on it. It's sharp. I mean, you know, and it's hot. It can kill you out there if you don't respect it. And so it ended up being almost like its own character that exuded that quality, that amoral, beyond good and evil kind of quality. And what does it mean to situate your life in such a thing as that? You know, and so I dealt with this myself just in writing that novel and working through those issues. And I think a kind of spirituality emerged from it, one of deep acceptance and acknowledgement and reverence for the powers of life, you know, that are just all around us, that sometimes it's easy to forget when we live our lives plugged into smartphones and computers.
That's exactly right. And I believe, I really strongly believe that these men and women of great faith often spent their times, you know, like Jesus, Muhammad, Abraham, in time in the desert, feeling exactly those feelings of like, of, in, you know, feeling like they're nothing in front of this great cosmos and the violence in that space. So I think, you know, that's where we can discover these truths for ourselves, is when we do spend time out in places like that. So, and that's certainly how I felt as well. So fantastic. So tell us a bit more about the book, because it's not actually a religious book, is it?
No, it's not at all. It's the story of a woman, a middle-aged woman, big city corporate executive type, who suddenly inherits about 12,000 acres of land in the West Texas desert, and she thinks to sell it, but ends up leaving her life in the big city behind and going out to start a new life out in the desert and finds love and adventure.
Fantastic. And it's called?
Quail Fried Rice.
Right. Okay. So, well, I'll put a link with that on the show notes.
Thank you.
I just had one more question before we finish, and that is the fear of criticism and the fear of offence that we all have, and I had prior to this conversation, which is I've never talked about this on my podcast before. You know, what is the feedback I'm going to get? You know, there's people on both sides of the whole argument that can often, you know, erupt over discussion of religion. And people say, you know, don't discuss religion or politics. But it is our, you know, our necessity as writers to discuss things that are difficult. So how do you, and I know you're on a lot of radio shows and you've put yourself out there, how do you deal with the criticism and the attack that can happen?
Well, they're going to just happen, and so you just have to make peace with it. I mean, as a scholar, you know, if you're going to have a career in the business of religious studies, as I have for the last 20 years, you just have to make peace with it, especially if you're a public scholar and you go outside the ivory tower. If you go out into the public, you're going to get that blowback, and so you just have to make peace with it. But you know, I do two things in my career that I try to minimize the attacks. One is I try to treat every topic within religion that I study or speak about, I treat it with respect. I respect the world's religions, and I respect religious people. This is the problem that I have with some of this new atheist ideology. Not that atheism as a belief system doesn't make perfect sense to me, but that its position seems to be that religious people are stupid.
Yeah.
And I just can't be with that. I respect religion, I respect religious people, and so I try to communicate that. I never want to demean anyone or their faith or think negatively about them because of it. And so I try to communicate that and sort of come from that posture as a scholar. The second thing is to inject some humor into it. I mean, religion is funny sometimes. I mean, religion is a way in which I think we can laugh at ourselves sometimes. I mean, we're just down here on this planet as human beings trying to make sense of things. And the religions are some of the most psychedelic, crazy things that we've ever created.
Yeah.
And it's fantastic. I mean, it's just absolutely fantastic. And so I think it's, if we can get to a place where we can have a little bit of humor about it, that can help. That can help kind of help us all to drink a little decaf.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. I think respect is incredibly important, and I do feel like on a bit of a knife edge, you know, with my novels, because it, you know, it's very difficult to be respectful and yet also write fiction. And some of the 1-star reviews on Amazon for my books have been, these are not Christian enough, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, you're going to get that. I mean, you're going to get it just like J.K. Rowling got it, just like the Da Vinci Code guy got it.
Yeah.
Because you're dealing, at least in that first one, you're dealing with those apostle stones. And so anytime you bring in a Christian theme, then certain kinds of Christians are going to react. And it would be the same thing if you chose something about Islam.
Yeah.
You know, if you pick some sort of thread out of Islamic history and use that instead of the Christian, you would get certain kinds of Muslims reacting. So I think that's just kind of the way of it, and you have to make peace with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, get a security detail if you need it.
Yeah, that's if I get as big as Salman Rushdie.
Yeah.
You know, or as rich as Dan Brown or J.K. Rowling, clearly. But no, I like that. And I think, again, I want to reemphasize to people that, you know, our job as writers is to get into things that matter to us and to other people. And I just don't understand it when people can write, you know, books and books and books and never even mention religion, when to me it's so central in the world, you know, politically and emotionally.
Oh yeah, it's part of the fabric of human life. And you know, I think our job as artists, I mean, if we're not going to get into the real nitty-gritty of things, why bother? And we have to have thick enough skin and a strong enough backbone to deal with the blowback. Because if you look at all great artists, whether they're visual or literary or whatever kind of artist they are, they push the edges. They challenge people. And that's part of what it means to do great, great work.
Yeah.
So I think we just have to take that on and be courageous and just go forward. And you can do that without being disrespectful.
Yeah, and that I think is also important to both of us anyway. But of course, people writing can write whatever they want to.
Yeah, exactly.
Great. Well, thanks ever so much for your time, Jill. So why don't you tell us where people can find you and your books online?
Yeah, I think probably the best place is just my central website, which is jillcarroll.com, J-I-L-L-C-A-R-R-O-L-L, jillcarroll.com, and then that'll link you out to anything else that I do.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again for your time. That was brilliant.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you, Joanna.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You can get more information on writing, publishing options, sales, and promotion for your book at www.thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And you can also get your free How to Be an Author workbook at www.howtobeanauthor.com. See you next time.